New Republic contributing editor Bob Moser, August 14, 2017. Trump is a sort of junior player in a bloc of authoritarian countries. He's part of the bloc that includes Vladimir Putin, Duterte. He's kind of part of an Axis power. He'd certainly like to murder people without due process. American Prospect senior correspondent Michelle Goldberg, August 17, 2018. We have a dangerous individual in the Oval Office who is a national security threat, and he needs to be removed from office. He's unfit, and he needs to be removed. MSNBC contributor Ronald Reagan Jr., May 22, 2017. He's unhinged. It's embarrassing. CNN host Don Lemon, August 22, 2017. We live in the age of the active shooter, and the president is goading them. He is inciting them. The blood will be on his hands the moment some whack job thinks that he's carrying out the instructions of a president and goes into a newsroom like the one behind us, or the one in my news organization or yours, and murdered people. The New York Times columnist Brett Stevens, August 6, 2018. It's hard to fire your son-in-law, but Mussolini had a great solution for that. He had him executed. So if I were Jared Kushner, I'd be a little careful. MSNBC host Chris Matthews, January 20, 2017. There are a variety of ways that Trump could kill us all. MTV's Jameel Smith. The party of Lincoln has become the party of Charlottesville, Arpaio, DACA repeal, and the Muslim ban. Embodying the very worst sentiments and driven by irrational anger, it deserves not defense but extinction. Washington Post columnist Jennifer Rubin, September 4, 2017. People are saying we have to talk about his health now before it's too late. Eugene Robinson saying, how long are we going to pretend that President Trump is fully rational? How long are we going to ignore the signs he's dangerously out of control? That's the question. I'm going to ask you, Jeff Greenfield, is now the time? CNN host Brian Stelter, December 3, 2017. How murderer Charles Manson and Donald Trump used language to gain followers. Newsweek headline, November 20, 2017. This is not a political party, Republicans. This is a domestic terror group. MSNBC guest Fernand Amandi, November 26, 2017. How surprised should we be? This is at least the fourth mass killing in America using an AR-15 since the Las Vegas massacre. At the center, an unapologetically incendiary president untrammeled by traditional norms of civility. ABC This Week's host George Stephanopoulos, October 28, 2018. And I think what he, Trump, has done over the course of the last few years is help foment this violence. New York Times columnist Maureen Dowd on ABC's This Week, October 28, 2018. The president is obviously a racist. He's obviously a demagogue. He obviously condones anti-Semitism, stokes up nationalist hatred. NBC and MSNBC national affairs analyst John Heilman, October 29, 2018. I can't even call him president, this demagogue, this nationalist. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough, October 29, 2018. This media pack malevolency toward President Trump and his party belies the press's self-serving claims of professionalism and high standards. Rather, it is every bit as tawdry or worse than the party press journalism of the early 1800s, which they claim to frown upon. Indeed, during the Trump presidency, the press has engaged in lies, distortions, sloppiness, and overall malpractice to an extent previously unseen in modern times. At one point, the Daily Wire kept a weekly tab of false media stories. The Federalist had its own list. Ex-CBS reporter Cheryl Atkinson maintains a running list of media mistakes during the Trump era. The Daily Caller kept a compilation of media screw-ups involving the Trump-Russia story, etc. A particularly notorious and pervasive illustration of press transgressions occurred on January 17, 2019, when BuzzFeed posted a headline screaming, President Trump directed his attorney Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. The subheadline declared, Trump received 10 personal updates from Michael Cohen and encouraged a planned meeting with Vladimir Putin. The crux of the story was that President Trump had directed Michael Cohen, his former lawyer and current felon, to lie to Congress about a real estate development in Moscow that ultimately never happened. BuzzFeed reported that President Donald Trump directed his longtime attorney Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about negotiations to build a Trump Tower in Moscow, according to two federal law enforcement officials involved in an investigation of the matter. Trump also supported a plan set up by Cohen to visit Russia during the presidential campaign in order to personally meet President Vladimir Putin and jumpstart the tower negotiations. "Make it happen," the sources said Trump told Cohen. And even as Trump told the public he had no business deals with Russia, the sources said Trump and his children Ivanka and Donald Trump Jr. received regular detailed updates about the real estate development from Cohen, whom they put in charge of the project. Now, BuzzFeed stated, the two anonymous law enforcement sources have told BuzzFeed News that Cohen also told the special counsel that after the election, the president personally instructed him to lie by claiming that negotiations ended months earlier than they actually did in order to obscure Trump's involvement. The special counsel's office learned about Trump's directive for Cohen to lie to Congress through interviews with multiple witnesses from the Trump Organization and internal company emails, text messages, and a cache of other documents. Cohen then acknowledged these instructions during his interviews with that office. For an entire day, news outlets and journalists breathlessly repeated the breaking BuzzFeed story. Some provided the occasional caveat, "if the story is true," a throwaway line meaning that while they could not or more likely would not bother to independently verify the accuracy of the story, they would repeat it anyway. Indeed, the story was not merely blared to the public with repeated headlines and extensive coverage, but the news story was imbued with wild speculation about the implications for the president. Again, a conga line of congressional Democrats, former federal prosecutors, and other experts were paraded through newsrooms and appeared on telecasts, claiming this was the bombshell that would result in President Trump's impeachment, if not secret and sealed indictment, speculating the president had committed obstruction of justice, etc. The Daily Caller reviewed television clippings from the Grabian News Service and reported that personalities on CNN and MSNBC used the words impeach, impeachment, or impeachable 179 times in less than one day of broadcasts. Newsbusters reported that despite the fact that the BuzzFeed news story was not confirmed by any news outlet, the NBC, ABC, and CBS broadcast networks devoted 27 minutes and 33 seconds on their Friday morning and evening newscasts, minus opening teases, to the story. Of course, all three networks pointed to the questionable veracity of the BuzzFeed piece to some degree, but they repeated the story nonetheless. After several days of this, the special counsel's office finally issued a statement denying the story. BuzzFeed's description of specific statements to the special counsel's office and characterization of documents and testimony obtained by this office regarding Michael Cohen's congressional testimony are not accurate. Perhaps as objectionable, if not more so, is the drive to smear President Trump as mentally unfit and malignantly unbalanced to hold office, in which his political opponents, helped by a cabal of mental health experts and eager news media, invoke the 25th Amendment to the Constitution as a legal basis and option for removing him from office. This is perhaps the most inflammatory, scurrilous, and pernicious allegation that can be made against a mentally healthy individual, but especially a president of the United States, as the purpose is to destroy his reputation with the public and foreign leaders and make governing as difficult as possible. Consequently, this, too, requires exploration. For example, on July 3, 2017, NBC News posted uncritically this story. House Democrats are on a mission to educate the American people about a little-known power of the 25th Amendment, the ousting of the president. Led by freshman Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, a group of growing Democratic co-signers has put forth a bill that could force President Donald Trump from office if he were found mentally or physically unfit. NBC continued, although it was introduced in April, the bill has gained steam in the past week as Trump's tweet storms have grown in ferocity. Given Donald Trump's continued erratic and baffling behavior, is it any wonder why we need to pursue this legislation? Asked Representative Darren Soto, Democrat of Florida, a co-signer. The mental and physical health of the leader of the United States and the free world is a matter of great public concern. These Democratic politicians were partly influenced by 27 psychiatrists, psychologists, and mental health practitioners who met in March of 2017 at what they labeled the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University to assess President Trump's mental health. The meeting was led by Professor Bandy X. Lee, M.D. The experts considered two questions. What's wrong with him, and does professional responsibility include a duty to warn the public if they believe the president is dangerously unfit for office? On October 3, 2017, they released their conclusions in a book titled The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump and summarized their position as follows. There are those who still hold out hope that this president can be prevailed upon to listen to reason and curb his erratic behavior. Our professional experience would suggest otherwise. Collectively, with our co-authors, we warn that anyone as mentally unstable as Mr. Trump simply should not be entrusted with the life and death powers of the presidency. It is revealing that in the book's prologue, Lee and Dr. Judith Lewis Herman disclose that soon after the presidential election of 2016, alarmed by the apparent mental instability of the president-elect, we both separately circulated letters among some of our professional colleagues, expressing our concern. Thus, their quest to alert the world to Donald Trump's alleged mental instability began immediately after his successful election over Hillary Clinton. The various essays in the book were written by different authors, each assigned a chapter with titles such as Unbridled and Extreme Present Hedonism, How the Leader of the Free World Has Proven Time and Again He is Unfit for Duty, Pathological Narcissism and Politics, A Lethal Mix, Sociopathy, Donald Trump is A, bad, B, mad, C, all of the above. Cognitive impairment, dementia, and POTUS. A clinical case for the dangerousness of Donald J. Trump. Trump anxiety disorder, the Trump effect on the mental health of half the nation and special populations. In relationship with an abusive president. Trump's daddy issues, a toxic mix for America. Who goes Trump? Tyranny as a triumph of narcissism. He's got the world in his hands and his finger on the trigger, the 25th Amendment solution. On January 3, 2018, Lee and congressional Democrats and one Republican senator met in secret. Politico reported, lawmakers concerned about President Trump's mental state summoned Yale University psychiatry professor Dr. Brandy X. Lee to Capitol Hill last month for 2 days of briefings about his recent behavior. In private meetings with more than a dozen members of Congress held on December 5th and 6th, Lee briefed lawmakers. Her professional warning to Capitol Hill, he's going to unravel and we are seeing the signs. The Democratic Party press was more than happy to use this slander against the president. In addition to Lee sitting for a number of interviews, the mental illness mantra was further employed by the press. For example, on January 3, 2018, NBC anchor Peter Alexander asked White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders if Americans should be concerned about the president's mental fitness after he tweeted that he has a bigger nuclear button than North Korea's dictator Kim has. Anchors and pundits on CNN began questioning Trump's mental stability, with media reporter Brian Stelter questioning whether the president had descended into madness. Concocting charges of mental illness backed by a relative handful of psychiatrists, psychologists, and mental health practitioners would be an extremely dangerous precedent and abuse of the Constitution if used as a basis for invoking the 25th Amendment. Apart from the vile allegations of mental unfitness against President Trump, discussed for months in the press, few news outlets bothered to explain, adequately or otherwise, the purpose of the 25th Amendment, ratified in 1967, how it works, and how politically complicated and constitutionally impracticable such an endeavor would be, even under the right circumstances. Section 4 of the 25th Amendment states, whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law provide, transmit to the president pro tempore of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office as acting president. The president has the right to challenge these actions, which in the end requires a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress to sustain. That was never going to happen. Therefore, the real purpose in this case appears to be to personally humiliate and politically damage President Trump. President Trump is not the first Republican to be targeted with politically charged claims of mental instability. In 1964, Senator Barry Goldwater was the Republican nominee for president, running against President Lyndon Johnson. Goldwater was also a conservative leader and therefore considered a political outsider. In September and October 1964, Fact magazine ran an entire issue on Goldwater's alleged mental unfitness for the Oval Office. It started with the title, 1,189 Psychiatrists Say Goldwater is Psychologically Unfit to Be President, the Unconscious of a Conservative, a Special Issue on the Mind of Barry Goldwater. The editor and publisher Ralph Ginsberg wrote in part, Mr. Goldwater's illness is not just an emotional maladjustment or a mild neurosis or a queerness. As emphatically stated by many of the leading psychiatrists in this country, the pattern of his behavior is ominous. From his sadistic childhood pranks to his cruel practical jokes today, from his nervous breakdowns under pressure in his 20s to his present-day withdrawals and escapes in time of crisis, from his obsessive preoccupation with firearms in his youth to his present fantasies about brandishing nuclear weapons to scare his enemies, from his conviction that he is surrounded by deadly enemies at home, whether labor leader Walter Reuther, Nelson Rockefeller, the American press, or someone who is out to kill him, to his belief that every Russian ballerina is a spy, he shows unmistakable symptoms of paranoia. Clearly, paranoia is not just any mental disease. In a leader who commands the most powerful nation and the most destructive arsenal in history, it constitutes nothing short of mortal danger to mankind. A little over 30 years ago, a paranoiac with a charismatic effect on his audiences, supported by an extremist, highly patriotic group, was democratically elected to the highest executive position in the government of his country. His name was Adolf Hitler. The magazine explained that it sent a questionnaire to all of the nation's 12,356 psychiatrists asking, "Do you believe Barry Goldwater is psychologically fit to serve as President of the United States?" In all, 2,417 psychiatrists responded. Of these, 571 said they did not know enough about Goldwater to answer the question. 657 said they thought Goldwater was psychologically fit, and 1,189 said that he was not. Fact also solicited comments from psychiatrists and published a sampling which it claimed constitute the most intensive character analysis ever made of a living human being. Needless to say, the published comments were vicious. As a result of the Fact article, in 1973, the American Psychiatric Association, APA, issued what became known as the Goldwater Rule. On occasion, psychiatrists are asked for an opinion about an individual who is in the light of public attention or who has disclosed information about himself or herself through public media. In such circumstances, a psychiatrist may share with the public his or her expertise about psychiatric issues in general. However, it is unethical for a psychiatrist to offer a professional opinion unless he or she has conducted an examination and has been granted proper authorization for such a statement. Nonetheless, the Goldwater Rule did not stop the psychobabble and public maligning of President Trump by the psychiatrists and others who had gathered at Yale and penned their book. Nor did it deter the Democratic Party press from fully and excitedly exploiting it. In fact, the media have gone even further. Donald Trump's supporters are even targeted for mental evaluation. On September 23, 2016, Bobby Azarian, Ph.D., a cognitive neuroscientist affiliated with George Mason University and a freelance journalist whose work has appeared in The Atlantic, The New York Times, BBC Future, Scientific American, Slate, The Huffington Post, Quartz, and others, wrote in Psychology Today that, "The only thing that might be more perplexing than the psychology of Donald Trump is the psychology of his supporters. In their eyes, the Donald can do no wrong." Even Trump himself seems to be astonished by this phenomenon. Azarian, therefore, will undertake the superhuman task of psychoanalyzing tens of millions of the president's supporters from his lofty media perch at Psychology Today. So how exactly are Trump loyalists psychologically or neurologically different from everyone else? What is going on in their brains that makes them so blindly devoted? Azarian argues there are four possibilities. 1. The Dunning-Kruger effect. Some believe that many of those who support Donald Trump do so because of ignorance. Basically, they are underinformed or misinformed about the issues at hand. 2. Hypersensitivity to threat. Science has unequivocally shown that the conservative brain has an exaggerated fear response when faced with stimuli that may be perceived as threatening. These brain responses are automatic and not influenced by logic or reason. Fear keeps Trump's followers energized and focused on safety. 3. Terror management theory. When people are reminded of their own mortality, which happens with fear-mongering, they will more strongly defend those who share their worldviews and national or ethnic identity, and act out more aggressively towards those who do not. By constantly emphasizing existential threat, Trump creates a psychological condition that makes the brain respond positively rather than negatively to bigoted statements and divisive rhetoric. 4. High attention engagement. Essentially, the loyalty of Trump supporters may in part be explained by America's addiction with entertainment and reality TV. He keeps us on the edge of our seat, and for that reason, some Trump supporters will forgive anything he says. They are happy as long as they are kept entertained. Azarian assures us that these explanations do not apply to all Trump supporters. In fact, some are likely intelligent people who know better but are supporting Trump to be rebellious or to introduce chaos into the system. They may have such distaste for the establishment and Hillary Clinton that their vote for Trump is a symbolic middle finger directed at Washington. Azarian's disdainful attitude about Trump and his supporters is typical and widespread throughout newsrooms. The Democratic Party press is incurious about and even blind to objective truth and the reality that surrounds them. On November 11, 2016, shortly after Donald Trump's election, Will Ron, CBS News digital political correspondent and the network's managing director of politics, wrote an extraordinary opinion piece, The Unbearable Smugness of the Press, in which he excoriated the Democratic Party press and fellow journalists. Here's part of what he said. The mood in the Washington press corps is bleak, and deservedly so. It shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that, with a few exceptions, we were all tacitly or explicitly hashtag with her, which has led to a certain anguish in the face of Donald Trump's victory. More than that, and more importantly, we also missed the story after having spent months mocking the people who had a better sense of what was going on. This is all symptomatic of modern journalism's great moral and intellectual failing, its unbearable smugness. Trump knew what he was doing when he invited his crowds to jeer and hiss the reporters covering him. They hate us and have for some time. And can you blame them? Journalists love mocking Trump supporters. We diagnose them as racists in the way Dark Age clerics confuse medical problems with demonic possession. Journalists at our worst see ourselves as a priestly caste. We believe we not only have access to the indisputable facts, but also a greater truth, a system of beliefs divine from an advanced understanding of justice. This is all a white lash, you see. Trump voters are racist and sexist, so there must be more racists and sexists than we realized. Journalists increasingly don't even believe in the possibility of reasoned disagreement, and as such ascribe cynical motives to those who think about things a different way. As a direct result, we get it wrong with greater frequency. Out on the road, we forget to ask the right questions. We can't even imagine the right question. We go into assignments too certain that what we find will serve to justify our biases. Unfortunately, Ron's wise counsel to his media colleagues has fallen on deaf ears. Indeed, despite Ron's warnings to his media colleagues, since the election, the Democratic Party press has unleashed a relentless and hellish campaign of insult and condemnation against President Trump, whom they seek to drive from office, and his supporters, for whom they have open disdain. Aside from certain news media platforms, a few cable programs, newspapers, and conservative talk radio, there is little current ability to counter or balance the large old media platforms of the Democratic Party press. Furthermore, the kinship between journalists and the Democratic Party and progressive ideology debases professional journalistic standards in which advocacy is treated and presented as news. One striking historical illustration of such behavior is portrayed in the 2012 book Yours in Truth, A Personal Portrait of Ben Bradlee, legendary editor of The Washington Post, authored by journalist Jeff Himmelman. Of course, The Washington Post is among the most influential news outlets in the country. It was instrumental in President Richard Nixon's downfall, with the assistance of leaks from the FBI, among others. Himmelman was a Washington Post journalist who had at one point reported directly to Bob Woodward. In writing his biography of Ben Bradlee, who had been the executive editor of the Post from 1968 to 1991, he was given full access to Bradlee, with whom he had worked and studied for 4 years, as well as Bradlee's personal papers. Bradlee, of course, had been treated as a press icon, most famously for his overseeing the publishing of the Pentagon Papers and the reporting on Watergate. Upon his death on October 21, 2014, Bradlee received lavish praise from the media class and many politicians, including President Barack Obama, for his courage and exceptionalism as a journalist and press executive. Obama issued a statement in which he said that the standard Bradlee set, a standard for honest, objective, meticulous reporting, encouraged so many others to enter the profession. When Himmelman's book was published, he was roundly criticized by Woodward and others in the press world because he dared to call into question Bradlee's exceptionally close friendship with President John Kennedy and certain of Bradlee's unethical journalistic practices when he was a correspondent for Newsweek covering Kennedy. From the time Kennedy was a senator, during his presidential campaign and throughout his short presidency, Bradlee and his wife, with the exception of a few-month period, were close friends. They were neighbors before Kennedy moved into the White House. They had frequent private dinners, went to the movies, attended dances, etc. The uniform perception is that most editors today would never allow a friend to cover a friend the way Ben covered Kennedy, Himmelman writes. Let us hope not. But the converse should be true as well. That is, if a journalist has deep-seated antipathy for a public figure, such as CNN's Jim Acosta or a host of other reporters for President Trump, they should never be allowed to cover that person either. Clearly, however, there is no such concern among editors today. In the case of Kennedy and Bradlee, Himmelman recounts that in May of 1959, before Kennedy had officially announced his candidacy for president, Ben covered a speech of Lyndon Johnson's in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, for Newsweek. At the time, Johnson was widely perceived to be one of Kennedy's potential rivals for the Democratic nomination. Ben filed for Newsweek, but he also wrote a private critical assessment of the speech in a memorandum for Senator John F. Kennedy that definitely crosses the line between what a reporter should and shouldn't do for a friend. He never mentioned having written this memo in any of his books or interviews. I found it at the Kennedy Library. Himmelman continued, after calling the speech a masterpiece of corn, Ben deconstructs Johnson's entire presentation. My own response to Johnson is that almost all other considerations aside, he could never make it. The image is poor. The accent hurts. He really does not have the requisite dignity. I watched closely. His personal mannerisms are destructive of the dignified image. He's somebody's Gabby, Texas cousin from Fort Worth. As an aside, one can imagine that this kind of attitude pervades and reflects present-day newsrooms respecting President Trump and his supporters. The evidence can be regularly seen and heard in daily news programs and commentaries, as described earlier. Bradlee further advised Kennedy that for safety's sake, I think your present assumption that he is a candidate has to be the one. The danger is, of course, not that he makes it or that he can hand his strength intact to anybody else. What is to be feared is that he will come to Los Angeles with a block of 300 or more delegates and hold them off the market for 3 or 4 ballots. Not only do you have to advance steadily, but you have to do it in pretty big leaps. This is the peril of Johnson. Every piece written that touts him as a candidate should, it seems to me, be read in this light rather than on its apparent face value. He's to be feared not as a potential winner, but as a game player who might try to maneuver you right out of the contest in Los Angeles. Himmelman reassures the reader that, for the most part, Ben stuck to being a reporter. Kennedy never gave Ben big scoops, particularly during the campaign, but he handed out tidbits. But the fact is, they were very close friends, as were their wives, as Himmelman explains throughout his book. And this undoubtedly affected Bradlee's reporting and Newsweek's coverage. Indeed, Himmelman reports on one of the sketchier episodes in their relationship when rumors had been circulating for a while that Kennedy had been married once before Jackie and that he had gotten a quickie divorce. Untrue, evidently, but lingering, probably because of some of the widespread extracurricular skinny-dipping that Kennedy was engaged in. Pierre Salinger, Kennedy's press secretary, negotiated to have Ben come up to Newport, Rhode Island, where Jackie's family had an enormous waterfront estate, Hammersmith Farm, to review FBI files that would prove that organizations spreading the rumors about Kennedy were shady themselves. This would discredit the opposition and advance a storyline that the administration wanted to advance. Kennedy shared FBI files with Bradley about shady organizations he wanted to discredit. And there was more to Himmelman's telling. On top of that, the president demanded approval over anything that ran in Newsweek. Bradley and Newsweek complied. "This is a right all presidents covet," Ben wrote later, "but which they should normally not be given. This one time the book seemed worth the candle, however, and we decided to strike the deal." In essence, Kennedy had editing control over the Bradley Newsweek story, which was intended to help Kennedy and involved Kennedy's sharing of FBI information with them. All of this was done in the shadows, and Bradley was compliant. At least the party press of old was honest enough to identify themselves as partisans, and for the most part, the public knew which newspaper stood with which party or candidate. Here and throughout the modern media, the bias may usually be determined by the news-consuming public from the content put out by the newsroom. Of course, there are also those who, when watching the news or reading the news, take it at face value. And there are times when you simply cannot discern truth from fiction. But the newsrooms themselves do not transparently label or self-identify their partisanship or bias, enabling the public to weigh and filter what is being presented to it. In fact, they protest when called out and claim that they are protecting freedom of the press against their critics. But are they? Or does the threat to press freedom lie with them? Chapter 4. The Real Threat to Press Freedom. When thinking of threats to freedom of the press, the usual scenario is of the government taking actions to intimidate or silence media organizations, journalists, etc. Today, the American media insist they are under an unprecedented barrage of rhetorical criticism from President Donald Trump, and that his calling media factions the enemy of the people or fake news, and using press events and political rallies to call out for criticism of individual news organizations and individual reporters, is a menace to freedom of the press. It is said that like no president before him, President Trump is using the language of a dictator and undermining the public's respect for the press. Therefore, pushback by the media is not only warranted but essential, as they are defending the First Amendment and freedom of the press, whereas President Trump is endangering them. So traumatized are the media by President Trump's verbal bouts with them that, led by the Boston Globe, they organized a coordinated editorial response. "We are not the enemy of the people," said Marjorie Pritchard, deputy managing editor for the Globe's editorial page and a leader of the media campaign. "I hope it would educate readers to realize that an attack on the First Amendment is unacceptable. We are a free and independent press. It is one of the most sacred principles enshrined in the Constitution." On August 15, 2018, more than 300 newspapers around the nation joined together to each publish editorials that explained the role of journalists and amplified the positive role journalism plays in society. The editorial in the Boston Globe is illustrative. Titled, "Journalists Are Not the Enemy," it states in part, "Replacing a free media with a state-run media has always been a first order of business for any corrupt regime taking over a country. Today in the United States, we have a president who has created a mantra that members of the media who do not blatantly support the policies of the current U.S. administration are the enemy of the people. This is one of the many lies that have been thrown out by this president, much like an old-time charlatan threw out magic dust or water on a hopeful crowd." Has President Trump advocated for state-run media? Ironically, the closest the United States comes to such official media are the public broadcasting system and National Public Radio. But any effort to eliminate taxpayer subsidies for these broadcast outlets is strongly opposed by, among others, other media outlets. but President Trump has never endorsed state-run journalism. Does the president demand that the media blatantly support his policies? This is an inaccurate characterization of his beef with the press. President Trump denounces what are often media-driven stories about such things as collusion with Russia, speculation about his mental health, gossip about his family members, predictions about indictments, demands for his impeachment, claims that he is a racist or white supremacist, charges of immigration, internment camps, etc. Indeed, on December 6, 2018, Real Clear Politics did an analysis of the media's Trump coverage and concluded it was obsessive. Since he rode down the Trump Tower escalator in June of 2015, Donald Trump has loomed large over the media landscape. From the mail bomber to the Khashoggi slaying to Bush 41's death, news outlets have organized their stories to emphasize Trump while often undermining his legitimacy. In doing so, the press has devoted so much attention to him that he has in some ways helped revive American journalism. It turns out the media's obsession with the president is greater than one might imagine. For example, focusing on cable channels CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News, Real Clear Politics found that while Obama typically hovered around 3% to 5% airtime over most of his presidency, Trump's steady state appears to be around 13% to 17%. In total, from June 2009 to January 20, 2017, Obama averaged around 4.9% of the combined daily airtime of CNN, MSNBC, and Fox News. From June 16, 2015 to present, Trump has averaged 15%, three times as much. Moreover, as reported by the Shorenstein Center on May 18, 2017 and referenced earlier, the center's study found that Trump's attacks on the press have been aimed at what he calls the mainstream media. Six of the seven U.S. outlets in our study, CBS, CNN, NBC, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Washington Post, are among those he's attacked by name. All six portrayed Trump's first 100 days in highly unfavorable terms. Again, Trump's coverage during his first 100 days was not merely negative in overall terms. It was unfavorable on every dimension. There was not a single major topic where Trump's coverage was more positive than negative. President Trump is not demanding slavish media support for his policies. He is rightly acknowledging the overwhelmingly negative coverage he receives from an extremely hostile media. And much of that is due to the progressive ideological mindset of America's newsrooms and their outrage over his electoral victory. The Globe editorial further laments that there was once broad bipartisan intergenerational agreement in the United States that the press played this important role. Yet that view is no longer shared by many Americans. The news media is the enemy of the American people is a sentiment endorsed by 48% of Republicans surveyed this month by Ipsos polling firm. That poll is not an outlier. One published this week found 51% of Republicans considered the press the enemy of the people rather than an important part of democracy. The Globe appears to conflate support for freedom of the press, which is a nonpartisan issue and undoubtedly embraced widely among Americans of all political stripes, especially Republican originalists and constitutionalists, with opposition by Republicans to the manner in which present-day journalists are almost single-mindedly and compulsively pursuing President Trump, his family, and his administration. More broadly, Republicans' objections relate to the modern view of news reporting, that is, the progressive, ideological, and partisan nature of reporting, rather than the principle of freedom of the press. Of course, the Globe editorial skirts this issue altogether, as it would require some level of self-evaluation and circumspection. On September 5, 2018, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press released a survey that found, among other things, that 95% of voters agree on the importance of having a free press. According to the survey, 56% of voters say they value the national news media most for its role in keeping citizens informed. However, perceived bias in reporting is a top concern, with 55% of both Republicans and independents citing journalists filtering all the news with their own political opinions as one of their biggest doubts about the national news media. Democrats are more concerned about sensationalizing news stories, with 52% citing it as their largest doubt. Unlike the Globe and the more than 300 other newspaper editorials, the survey also found that A majority of voters, 52%, said they did not see press freedom as under threat, a lack of perceived risk that was even higher among some when viewed through a partisan lens. 66% of Republicans and 56% of independents said they perceived little or no threat to the press, while just 38% of Democrats gave the same response. Could it be that the public is right and the media are wrong? Is President Trump's criticism of press coverage an existential threat to the freedom of the press? Of course not. However, there are numerous examples of past presidents taking governmental actions that did in fact suppress press freedom. The Globe editorial ignored these past presidential acts, for to acknowledge them would provide context for the reader and undermine the newspaper's entire proposition and anti-Trump campaign. Interestingly, the Globe editorial highlights a quote from founding father John Adams. "The liberty of the press is essential to the security of freedom." Yet incongruously and intentionally, it expurgates by omission President Adams' grievous attack on press freedom. Not long after the nation's founding, President Adams and his Federalist Party instituted the Sedition Act of 1798. As Richard Buell Jr. of Wesleyan University explained, "Men in the thick of a revolution may well be forgiven if they sacrifice principles to the needs of a desperate moment. But the events of the late 1790s cannot be so explained." Less than 10 years after framing the First Amendment, Congress passed and President Adams signed the Sedition Law. It made illegal the following: to write, print, utter, or publish, or cause it to be done, or assist in it, any false, scandalous, and malicious writing against the government of the United States, or either House of Congress, or the President, with intent to defame or bring either into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against either the hatred of the people of the United States, or to stir up sedition, or to excite unlawful combinations against the government, or to resist it, or to aid or encourage hostile designs of foreign nations. Armed with this statute, Buell writes, the Secretary of State Timothy Pickering proceeded to launch a systematic attack on the major opposition presses, clearly with the design of silencing them during the election of 1800. In addition, several Republican printers in the states with Federalist-controlled judicial systems were prosecuted under the common law. No one could seriously have doubted that these prosecutions represented a deliberate attempt to muzzle the Republican presses. Nevertheless, Federalists maintained that nothing, either in the Sedition Law or its administration, was inconsistent with the First Amendment, and that the law actually expanded the freedom of publishers by liberalizing the common law of libels. The revolutionaries had an explanation for the apparent conflict between their words and deeds. None had ever denied that the press could abuse its privileges and that such abuse should be restrained. The Adams administration actually prosecuted more than 24 individuals, including journalist Thomas Cooper, editor of the North Cumberland Gazette in Pennsylvania, James Callender, a writer with the Richmond Examiner in Virginia, and Charles Holt, editor of the New London Bee in Connecticut, all of whom were fined and served prison sentences, and all of whom were more sympathetic to the Jeffersonian Republican cause. Among other things, Adams and his party, witnesses to the bloody French Revolution and the ensuing decade-long upheaval of that society, claimed the Sedition Law would not prevent legitimate criticism of the government and the exercise of press freedom, but would restrain lies from various factions and groups aimed at delegitimizing democratic rule. The Jeffersonian Republicans countered that political criticism necessarily contained opinion as well as fact, and that no jury could determine the truth or falsehood of an opinion. Moreover, various state laws provided recourse for seditious libel. With Thomas Jefferson's victory in 1800, and his more libertarian beliefs as well as the Republican takeover of Congress, the Sedition Act would die and freedom of the press would be honored. Despite extraordinary provocations, the Republicans never responded as the Federalists had in the analogous circumstances of the late 1790s. Decades later, during the Civil War, Abraham Lincoln and the Republicans were dealing with the gravest threat to the Republic since its founding, a war over secession and slavery that engulfed the country, eventually resulting in more than 700,000 casualties. Historian Harold Holzer noted that, following the first Bull Run disaster, the administration turned its attention not only to forging weaponry and raising more troops, but also to quelling Homefront newspaper criticism that the president, his cabinet advisors, and more surprisingly many northern newspaper editors, believed was morphing from tolerable dissent into nation-threatening treason. The Lincoln administration believed that in the case of an unprecedented rebellion and under the powers the president had claimed in order to crush it, military necessity superseded constitutional protection. Based on this argument, the administration began conducting, or when it occurred spontaneously tolerating, repressive actions against opposition newspapers. As time went on, the military and the government began punishing editorial opposition to the war itself. Authorities banned pro-peace newspapers from the U.S. mails, shut down newspaper offices, and confiscated printing materials. They intimidated and sometimes imprisoned reporters, editors, and publishers who sympathized with the South or objected to armed struggle to restore the Union. For the first year of the war, Lincoln left no trail of documents attesting to any personal conviction that dissenting newspapers ought to be muzzled. But neither did he say anything to control or contradict such efforts when they were undertaken by his cabinet officers or military commanders. Lincoln did not initiate press suppression and remained ambivalent about its execution, but seldom intervened to prevent it. St. Michael's College professor David T.Z. Mindich adds that, in 1862, after Lincoln appointed him Secretary of War, Edwin M. Stanton penned a letter to the president requesting sweeping powers, which would include total control of the telegraph lines. By rerouting those lines through his office, Stanton would keep tabs on vast amounts of communication, journalistic, governmental, and personal. On the back of Stanton's letter, Lincoln scribbled his approval. "The Secretary of War has my authority to exercise his discretion in the matter within mentioned." Having the telegraph lines running through Stanton's office made his department the nexus of war information. Lincoln visited regularly to get the latest on the war. Stanton collected news from generals, telegraph operators, and reporters. He had a journalist's love of breaking the story and an autocrat's obsession with information control. He used his power over the telegraphs to influence what journalists did or didn't publish. In 1862, the House Judiciary Committee took up the question of telegraphic censorship and called for restraint on the part of the administration's censors. On May 18, 1864, the Associated Press distributed what turned out to be a forged copy of a presidential proclamation. Its inauthenticity was unknown to the publishers and editors of the pro-Democrat, anti-war New York World and New York Journal of Commerce newspapers, who fell for the ruse and printed it. The document urged a national day of fasting, humiliation, and prayers, hinted darkly about the general state of the country, and called for a breathtaking 400,000 new volunteers. With Ulysses S. Grant enduring a bloodbath of casualties in a struggle to subdue Robert E. Lee in Virginia, the proclamation seemed a cry of desperation, an admission that to prevail, the Union required both divine intervention and a huge infusion of fresh troops. It was major news. An outraged Lincoln took direct action, believing these papers were damaging the Union effort, and issued an executive order stating, "Whereas there has been wickedly and traitorously printed and published this morning in the New York World and New York Journal of Commerce, newspapers printed and published in the city of New York, a false and spurious proclamation purporting to be signed by the President and to be countersigned by the Secretary of State, which publication is of a treasonable nature, designed to give aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States and to the rebels now at war against the government and their aiders and abettors. You are therefore hereby commanded forthwith to arrest and imprison in any fort or military prison in your command the editors, proprietors, and publishers of the aforesaid newspapers, and all such persons as, after public notice has been given of the falsehoods of said publication, print and publish the same, with intent to give aid and comfort to the enemy. And you will hold the persons so arrested in close custody until they can be brought to trial before a military commission for their offense. You will also take possession by military force of the printing establishments of the New York World and Journal of Commerce, and hold the same until further orders, and prohibit any further publication therefrom." Major General John Adams Dix was ordered to execute the presidential directive, which he did reluctantly. The two papers were shut down and the two editors detained at Army headquarters. Dix soon uncovered the perpetrator of the hoax, a one-time New York Times correspondent, Joseph Howard Jr. On May 21, 1864, both editors were permitted to reopen their newspapers. However, Lincoln's angry reaction to the two newspapers apparently was less about a hoax and more about the fact that the night before the publication of the forged presidential proclamation, the president had been working on an authentic proclamation that indeed called for more troops, 300,000 more, by either enlistment or conscription. The published forgery unleashed panic within the White House and cabinet that someone may have leaked a genuine proclamation and potentially harmed the war effort. During the course of another war, this time World War I, President Woodrow Wilson, who had been a leading progressive intellectual for decades, supported a series of congressional amendments that Congress added to the Espionage Act, which collectively became known as the Sedition Act of May 16, 1918. The act stated in part, "Whoever, when the United States is at war, shall willfully utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the form of government of the United States, or the Constitution of the United States, or the military or naval forces of the United States, or the flag of the United States, or the uniform of the Army or Navy of the United States into contempt, scorn, contumely, or disrepute, shall be punished by a fine of not more than $10,000, or the imprisonment for not more than 20 years, or both. Provided that any employee or official of the United States government who commits any disloyal act or utters any unpatriotic or disloyal language or who in an abusive and violent manner criticizes the Army or Navy or the flag of the United States shall be at once dismissed from the service." Numerous opponents of Wilson's war policies were charged and imprisoned. Indeed, Wilson had already instituted extensive measures to curtail press freedom. Christopher B. Daly, professor at Boston University, has written that during the lead-up to America's entrance into World War I, the Wilson administration took immediate steps at home to curtail one of the pillars of democracy, press freedom, by implementing a plan to control, manipulate, and censor all news coverage on a scale never seen in U.S. history. Following the lead of the Germans and British, Wilson elevated propaganda and censorship to strategic elements of all-out war. Even before the U.S. entered the war, Wilson had expressed the expectation that his fellow Americans would show what he considered loyalty. Wilson started one of the earliest uses of government propaganda. He waged a campaign of intimidation and outright suppression against those ethnic and socialist papers that continued to oppose the war. Taken together, these wartime measures added up to an unprecedented assault on press freedom. Wilson also created an elaborate domestic spy network to watch German immigrants and American radicals. Federal agents arrested hundreds for making anti-war speeches and sometimes for informal and private remarks. Eugene Debs, four-time presidential candidate for the Socialist Party, was arrested in June 1918 for suggesting during a speech that young American men were fit for something better than slavery and cannon fodder. Sentenced to 10 years in prison, he defiantly ran for president in 1920 from his jail cell in Atlanta and received almost 1 million votes. During the war, more than 2,000 men and women were arrested for disloyal speech, and over 1,200 went to jail. Furthermore, Wilson issued an executive order on April 13, 1917, establishing the Committee on Public Information, CPI, a massive propaganda machine that would put the government in the business of actively shaping press coverage about the war. Wilson appointed a former journalist and loyal political supporter, George Creel, to lead the operation. The CPI was a veritable magnet for political progressives of all stripes, intellectuals, muckrakers, even some socialists, all sharing a sense of the threat to democracy posed by German militarism. The Wilson administration planted official news stories with media outlets, published an official government newspaper that was widely distributed, and secured free advertising and press publications. The CPI had a film division, foreign language newspaper division, advertising division, and speakers division. At the same time, the government severely limited press access to people and operations related to the war effort. The CPI was pervasive. The CPI mobilized 150,000 American word maestros to pitch America's involvement in the war as necessary and noble, Commandeering the 4 minutes projectionists needed to change movie reels, Creel and his people trained 75,000 citizens to deliver seemingly impromptu, carefully coached, perfectly timed 4 minute pro-war harangues. Creel would estimate his speakers delivered 755,190 talks and papered the country with 1,438 different posters. David T. Beto, professor at the University of Alabama, has written of President Franklin Roosevelt's war against the press during the New Deal and later World War II. For example, at its inception in 1934, the Federal Communications Commission, FCC, reduced the license renewal period for stations from 3 years to only 6 months. This would allow Roosevelt maximum authority over the life and death of radio stations. Meanwhile, Roosevelt tapped Herbert L. Petty as secretary of the FCC and its predecessor, the Federal Radio Commission. Petty had overseen radio for Roosevelt in the 1932 campaign. After his appointment, he worked in tandem with the Democratic National Committee to handle radio matters with both the networks and local stations. It did not take long for broadcasters to get the message. NBC announced that it was limiting broadcasts contrary to the policies of the United States government. CBS Vice President Henry A. Bellows said that no broadcast would be permitted over the Columbia Broadcasting System that in any way was critical of any policy of the administration. He elaborated that the Columbia system was at the disposal of President Roosevelt and his administration, and they would permit no broadcast that did not have his approval. Local station owners and network executives alike took it for granted, as editor and publisher observed, that each station had to dance to government tunes because it is under government license. But Roosevelt's manipulation and reach went well beyond the nascent broadcast media. Beto explained that Roosevelt's intimidation efforts reached their apogee in the hands of the Special Senate Committee on Lobbying. The president indirectly recruited Senator Hugo L. Black, a Democrat from Alabama, a zealous and effective New Deal loyalist, as chair. The Black Committee undertook a wide-ranging investigation into anti-New Deal critics, including journalists. Black was granted access to tax returns dating back to 1925 of such critics as David Lawrence of the United States News. He then demanded that his targets turn over their private telegrams, and the telegraph companies let the committee search copies of all incoming and outgoing telegrams for the first 9 months of 1935. When Western Union refused on privacy grounds, the FCC, at Black's urging, ordered it to comply. The extent of the government's intrusion into private telegram communications was shocking. Over a nearly 3 month period at the end of 1935, writes Beto, FCC and Black Committee staffers searched great stacks of telegrams in Western Union's D.C. office. Operating with virtually no restriction, they read the communications of sundry lobbyists, newspaper publishers, and conservative political activists, as well as every member of Congress. Writing to Black, one investigator stated that they had gone through 35,000 to 50,000 telegrams per day. Various newspapers and members of Congress later estimated that staffers had examined some 5 million telegrams over the course of the investigation. The committee used the information it found as a basis for more than 1,000 new subpoenas. One of these was for all incoming and outgoing telegrams, not just those sent through Washington, D.C., of W.H. Cowell's anti-New Deal newspaper chain in the Northwest. Hugo Black would become Roosevelt's first appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. Early in his career, he had been a member of the Ku Klux Klan. In another example, Beto writes that during the 1930s, newspaper publisher Edward Rumley formed an alliance with other New Deal critics, including newspaper publisher Frank Gannett and the well-known conservationist and civil libertarian Amos Pinchot. On the same day that Franklin Roosevelt announced his court-packing plan in 1937, the trio organized the Committee for Constitutional Government, CCG. Gannett wrote the checks, and Rumley ran day-to-day operations. CCG led perhaps the first successful offensive against the New Deal, pioneering the use of direct mail and helping to defeat the court-packing plan. For this, Rumley was singled out by Roosevelt's congressional loyalists. It didn't take long for Democrats to strike back. In 1938, Senator Sherman Minton of Indiana announced a sweeping investigation of lobbies, targeting forces opposed to the objectives of the administration. Minton committee staff arrived en masse at CCG's office, where they began copying files. After watching this for several hours, Rumley ordered them out, charging them with an illegal fishing expedition. Minton's undoing, however, was his proposal to make it a felony to publish as a fact anything known to be false. The resulting public backlash over a perceived threat to free speech led to the collapse of the investigation. Over the next decade, CCG distributed over 82 million pieces of literature, criticizing such policies as expanded government medical insurance, public housing, and labor legislation. Roosevelt was also a huge admirer of George Creel, Woodrow Wilson's top propagandist. In his book, FDR and the Press, Graham J. White explained, "Unbeknown, apparently, to the Washington Press, Roosevelt repeatedly used Creel's articles to outline his plans and purposes and to test public reaction to them. Often Roosevelt actually dictated whole paragraphs to Creel for opinion pieces Roosevelt would write and speeches he would deliver." Roosevelt was known to give a tongue-lashing to the media during contentious periods of his presidency, as have other presidents. But he sought to separate media owners, publishers, and columnists from the so-called working press, and in this he had great success. While many who have written on this subject credit Roosevelt's adeptness at press relations, what they do not admit is the provable fondness for Roosevelt's progressive domestic agenda by the working press. It is also a principal reason they tolerated Roosevelt's and Wilson's violations of press freedom and championed many of his New Deal programs. James E. Pollard, who in 1947 wrote about the relationship between presidents and the press, said of Roosevelt in part that his administration periodically sounded the alarm about the U.S. press. It was false to its trust, it failed to give the public the whole story, it played down anything favorable to the administration and exaggerated what was bad, it manufactured anti-Roosevelt stuff out of whole cloth, it was owned and controlled by men of predatory wealth. By the same token, writers, editors, and publishers, not so much the working press, were forever reading danger to the freedom of the press and the acts and attitudes of the administration. They saw it in presidential actions and utterances. They sensed it in New Deal legislation. They scented it in the actions of subordinates or of the New Deal agencies. In fact, some prominent individuals feared that Roosevelt was intent on suppressing media owners and publishers. Pollard explained, "Each saw only the worst in the other. To borrow the Roosevelt expression, both were seeing things under the bed. Yet the columnist General Hugh Johnson, at one time in the confidence of the president, asserted that the administration attacks on the press had appeared over long enough periods of time and with enough consistency to indicate a policy or at least a conviction. He feared that they were opening steps in a furtive purpose to suppress or soften criticism of governmental action by legislation, intimidation, or whatever it takes." However, as Pollard wrote, the Roosevelt strength in dealing with the working press lay in the fact that he found common ground with the correspondents. He understood their needs and their problems. He faced them as man to man, usually with no holds barred. He matched wits with them, he fenced with them, he was quite frank with them in most matters. His achievements in these respects far outran those of any of his predecessors. He was a master of the art of applied psychology in the field of broad public relations. Therefore, other than all the press manipulation, threats, and suppression, the working press of the United States is forever in Roosevelt's debt for meeting it on common ground over so many critical years. The same can be said of President Barack Obama, of course, and his relationship not just with the working press, but with media owners, publishers, and commentators. Like Roosevelt, Obama acted against the media in a variety of significant ways. A retired Washington Post executive editor writing on the opinion page explained that the Justice Department secretly subpoenaed and seized from telephone companies 2 months of records for 20 AP phone lines and switchboards used by more than 100 reporters and 4 of its news bureaus. The Obama administration subpoenaed and seized records of telephone calls and emails between several New York Times reporters and government officials, between a Fox News reporter and a State Department contract analyst, and between 2 journalists and a former CIA officer. Specifically, in 2010, the FBI spied on James Rosen, a then Fox News reporter, collecting his cell phone records, seizing 2 days of his personal emails, and using his State Department security badge to track his movements in and out of the department. The FBI also accused him of violating the Espionage Act of 1917, at the very least either as an aider, abettor, and or co-conspirator with one of his government sources. James Risen, a reporter for the New York Times, was also treated as a co-conspirator with a government source who was indicted by the Obama administration under the Espionage Act of 1917. Risen was subpoenaed. The government sought access to his phone and computer records, tried to compel him to testify against one of his sources, and for several years threatened him with imprisonment. Risen would later describe the Obama administration as the greatest enemy of press freedom in a generation. The Associated Press found that the Obama administration used the 1917 Espionage Act with unprecedented vigor, prosecuting more people under that law for leaking sensitive information to the public than all previous modern administrations combined. Obama's Justice Department dug into confidential communications between news organizations and their sources as part of that effort. In response to the Obama administration's surveillance of the Associated Press, its CEO, Gary Pruitt, asserted that these records potentially reveal communications with confidential sources across all of the news-gathering activities undertaken by the AP during a 2-month period, provide a roadmap to AP's news-gathering operations, and disclose information about AP's activities and operations that the government has no conceivable right to know. The Obama administration also briefly entertained the idea of overseeing the content of radio programming because of the structural imbalance of such content. The draft proposal from the Federal Communications Commission's legal department included a program